For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Oh, what are you doing? I'll tell you what you're doing. You're listening to the Elder Scrolls Lorecast. Either you are, or I'll be skipping rope with your entrails. Ta-ta.
This is the Elder Scrolls Lorecast, your source for lore and so much more. Adventurers, welcome back to the Elder Scrolls Lorecast. You got me, Tom, and Lotus, as usual. We're following up on last week's episode about necromancy because we went over some of the gory basic details.
Yeah, but how it all works.
Yeah, but this week we're talking a little bit about the history and a little bit about the way the different cultures engage or don't engage with necromancy across Tamriel. So it's kind of a follow-up episode. And then next week, Lotus is working on his Dramothra research in order to talk. We're going to combine a little bit of necromancy, a little bit of astronomy, like all that.
Yeah, it's just, it seemed like, again, it was kind of surprising we hadn't overtly done anything like with a Dramothra episode. And I felt it was kind of a good closure to, we did the astrology thing and we're doing the necromancy thing. And I really love the Dramothra lore. I think it's super cool. So it just seemed like a fun way to kind of combine both things together to end this little section, because we've sort of, I mean, when applicable, we group things together.
Yeah,
yeah. Seemed like a good closure to this little section because it kind of involves a little of both and a whole bunch of Namira.
That's true, yeah, and Namira. So you got that, which is always fun. Anytime a Daedric Prince is involved, it's fun. And speaking of Daedric Prince, this is not a segue at all. One other thing I wanted to wanted to put in here right at the beginning of the episode is that I have been working. We've still got our giveaway. You've still got 2 weeks left to get your recommendations for Skyrim challenges on the Patreons. Patreon.com/Elder Scrolls Lorecast. It's free. Just sign up for free and comment on the post about, hey, give us your recommendations. And truth be told, there aren't that many people commenting, even though this will give you the newest expansion for ESO and the base game if you don't have it. Plus, you can take that code and give it to a friend or whatever if you win. So go check that out. Come up with a fun way to play Skyrim. Look up other people's playthroughs or go check out the video that I just posted where I am playing. And this is on, I'm revising an old channel. It is now called Tom or Robots. That's the name of this YouTube channel where I'm putting these challenges up. And the first challenge is up. It's highly edited. I spent a ton of time working on it. Tried to do like really high quality stuff and people seem to really be enjoying it. And it's basically my attempt at a permadeath playthrough where every time I attack an enemy, my weapon changes randomly.
Sounds incredibly disorienting.
It's a little insane, and it's on expert difficulty plus combat mods, which makes it feel a lot closer to legendary in difficulty. I have to be very, very careful, and it's permadeath. So it's super fun. It's up on, so look up Tom or Robots on YouTube. You'll find my newest newest YouTube channel. You can check out the video. And if you want to support what I'm doing, what Lotus and I are doing, go check out his channel, go check out that channel and help me get it monetized. We're about 350-ish subscribers in already and we got to get to 1,000. And if you enjoy the video, that would be amazing if you like and subscribe and do all the YouTube stuff. But anyway, let's move on because we have necromancy to talk about again. You ready, Lotus?
Yeah, let's. Actually, you know what? There's no segue that's actually good for that. They're all gross.
They're all gross.
I'm just not giving any segue. Yes, let's do this.
Okay. So let's get started here. So let's dive in a little bit to the history of necromancy. And it is, like many things in Elder Scrolls, shrouded in mystery. Because once you go back past the Second Age into the First Age, into the Morrithic era, there's like a lot of vagueness about things, but it seems like necromancy may be one of those magical practices that has been around before recorded history. And seems also like it's the kind of thing that most cultures have typically banned. That seems pretty common throughout most of history.
Yeah, it's definitely more of a taboo thing. So you are an outlier if you're okay with necromancy, more so than the inverse of that.
Right, and historically that seems to be the case. But we're going to get to it in a little bit. There are some cultures that actually don't seem that taboo about it. Mm-hmm. And in some places, it's a little bit more legal than other places, which is interesting. But the history goes back way before we actually have any history books about it. Playing through ESO and some of the necromancy stuff they've added in there has revealed that, like, the Sigic Order was condemning necromancy very early on in the histories. The Mages Guild was formed, I believe, in the Second Era, also mm-hmm. condemned necromancy. That became kind of a hot topic, and they decided that that was not good. And basically anybody who had any connection to magic across, you know, in some sort of official capacity, like across the imperial expanse of Tamriel, pretty much banned it, and for good reasons.
Yeah, as we went over last time, I mean, it's very hard to justify the ends of being a necromancer and not having it lead to horrific levels of corruption.
Yes, yes. Now, speaking of corruption, this is a good segue. The very first necromancer might actually be somebody that we are all familiar with, Manimarco, who shows up as a villain across the series and may, in some regards, and of course, all this stuff is foggy, right? A lot of there's a lot of, like, different people telling different versions of history. And of course, Manimarco is not going to be the best source of his own history because he's going to want people to perceive him in a certain way because he's a terrible, evil guy.
Yeah, nobody's the villain of their own story.
Right, right. But it seems like he might actually be one of the oldest people in all of Elder Scrolls history. He may be the very first actual true necromancer. Not that he was the first to dabble in necromancy, but the first to really develop it into something that worked and allowed him to transcend his own lifespan, you know, seek to achieve lichdom, all of that stuff. So it goes way, way back to the point that he may not even be an Altmer, like current high elves are all Altmer. He might actually be an Aldmer before that division happened in their history, which is kind of mind blowing when you think about it.
Yeah, that's like kind of wild era. If that's the case. But you're, again, we're dealing with somebody who's been around for a very long time, both in lore and also literally in the games. I mean, he spans a lot of the game entries as well.
Yes, yes. So that would also mean that he has lived through the Middle Dawn, which was a dragon break. So he would have been a survivor of at least one, if not multiple, dragon breaks.
Which is pretty wild again.
Yes, also very, very crazy. Now, there is a poem about Manimarco which calls him the world's first of the Undying Liches. But there are definitely conflicting accounts that claim that there probably were other liches before him. So, again, this might be just his own bravado saying, well, no, I'm the first real lich or something like that.
Sure.
We don't really
again,
know.
Nobody's going to be the villain or the second place. And it's like, oh, no, I was actually the first. Were you? I mean, yeah. It seems like it's very plausible, but yes. When you have this much time spanning, it becomes very difficult to iron out exacts.
Right. And in his ascent to lichdom and the power that necromancy would bring him, he would speak down about any other previous or contemporary necromancers, basically like, they didn't truly understand the power that they could wield, but I do. And so therefore he created his own group, the Order of the Black Worm, and then he got all these fun names. And we've talked about Manimarco before. Go check out the rest. We don't want to spend the rest on just him. But there was definitely that stuff going on. And then on top of it, as a necromancer, his main adversary in his mind was Arke, the Aedra, the of the divines, because Arke, you know, god of life and death, basically doesn't
right.
want
I mean,
people
it,
messing
it
with
it.
Kind of
goes hand in hand.
Right, right. So that's some fun stuff to kick this off. That seems to be where the power of necromancy really, really took hold, and other necromancers were like, oh, Manimarco could do it. Maybe I can do it. But here, let's transition. Let's talk about some different locations. Let's travel to the marshes in the south. Let's go down to Black Marsh. Now, let's think, as we go to these different locations in these different cultures, think about the way that the cultures work, but also the climate of the area works and how that would work with necromancy. So Lotus, what's it like down in Black Marsh?
It's beautiful. It's temperate. No, it's awful. It's super humid. It's hot. There's a reason that no one can really get much of a foothold to conquer the area.
Yeah.
Because it's even difficult. Having so much as standing structures becomes problematic.
Things sink in the marsh. The marsh kind of destroys anything that like dies in it. Like,
right. All of the creatures essentially are incredibly hostile. With the voraplasms, like basically consuming things. You also have a weird side effect of not really necromancy, but something that's, you know, freaking people out in some of the stories. Actually, the Skyrim book, A Dance in Fire, is a story with Decimus Scotty, I believe his name is, where, you know, he goes on his little adventures down there and stuff like that to try to get a foothold for trade. And the voraplasms and all these horrible creatures that live in the swamp and the muck, they basically will consume creatures and not reanimate them in a way of like they're resurrecting them, but they will enshroud the body and move it like a vessel because it's more efficient. So it looks like a zombie and it's like, okay, this is just like this primordial goop that's basically eaten this thing and now using it to its own end, which
like,
is just
like a body
horrifying.
Stuck in goo that's being animated by the goo, not
just
by the body.
Horrifying.
Yeah, pretty horrifying. So the marshes of Black Marsh are a wet environment. What happens in these wet environments? Well, things decay very quickly. Yeah. So dead bodies don't stick around very long for necromancers to come and reanimate them. So you've got that. You also have Argonian tribes, which make this a very difficult place to be doing anything against what the tribes believe. And they don't believe in necromancy. The Hist doesn't believe in necromancy. They're not for that. So the culture and the location are both very against necromancy. But yet, in spite of all of this, it seems that at some points in history, the Slowed have been able to actually occupy parts of this area and use necromancy. Because, of course, the Slowed would, being these big, you know, fat worm guys who have
slug
no morals.
Blobs,
slug blobs with no morals. So it makes sense that they would find a place like this because it's kind of isolated. They're not bothered. And also they are very powerful mages. So they would have ways of like taking a body, killing it, and then keeping it from just falling into the muck and
falling apart. Plus, like you just alluded to, their moral compass is non-existent.
All right, so let's head north. We're going to go to the center of the continent, to Cyrodiil. And Cyrodiil has a very diverse history. I mean, there's the early parts where it was being explored. There's the time where it was controlled by the Aeliads in like the Mirthic in the First Age. Then the Empire rises. All of these different groups have different expectations and beliefs around necromancy, right? So you might be most familiar with the Imperials. The Imperials generally not in favor of necromancy. They're not big fans of it, right?
Yeah, they'll take a hard pass for the most part.
But there are times in the history where they've hired necromancers and supplied them with corpses from like criminals or traitors. The Empire, on occasion, will do what they need to do in order to maintain the power and control that they have. So
yeah, power changes people's morals real quick.
Yeah. So, and there's some conflict between, you know, the rise of Mayor Marco, Order of the Black Worm, and the conflicts that go around during that time. But for the most part, the Empire is generally not about it. The Mages Guild, who operates within the Empire, generally not about it. But if we go further back in time, we get to the Aeliads. And much like the Slowed, the Aeliads were all for all sorts of moral ambiguity.
Yeah, I'd say it's not even morally ambiguous. I think they're just down with it most of the time.
Most of the time they are kind of,
they got their gut gardens and other weird stuff just for when they're bored. It's like, oh, all right.
Yes. So the Aeliads, being a group of elves who divided from the Aldmer in a very early part of history, would have had a lot of the same knowledge coming from the Aldmer about magic and those kinds of things. It turns out that the Aeliads were actually very good at necromancy. They had a lot of knowledge around it. And so maybe that is even more proof for somebody like Manor Marco coming from the Aldmer and that knowledge being part of both of those cultures. So could be a thing.
I mean, especially to like you said, that might have, outside the moral ambiguity of Manimarco in general, it's like, if that's what you grow up with, it might not seem weird if he's actually an Altmer as opposed to an Altmer.
Right, right. And those cultures change over time. The Altmer definitely change over time. Even in the different eras, you have, you know, the rise of the Thalmor. We've talked about this before. Right. The Thalmor in older parts of history had a different role than they do in the third and fourth era. Right. So that changes over time. But the other thing about the Aeliads is they may not have just focused on necromancy for the sake of necromancy. They also worshipped a lot of Daedric princes. And so this power of necromancy may have been partly to do with their reliance on that worship and doing the deeds that the Daedric princes would want them to do. And Daedric princes don't really care about, you know, people and their willingness to have their bodies reanimated or whatever.
Yeah. Again, it's one of those, like, that we're sort of nothing entities. So it's like, well, they're rarely do they go out of their way to screw with people. I mean, some do, but
some do.
So, yeah. It depends on their sphere of influence.
Sheogorath. Yeah.
Right. I was going to say, it depends on their sphere of influence, but like, for the most part, it's just kind of like, we're there because we're there. Which means they have no concerns about, like, oh, well, you know, does this hurt? Who cares? Like, it doesn't matter if it hurts or if it's miserable or if it's great or whatever. It's, what does it relate to them and nothing more?
Right. And in fact, we do know that they, some of the Aeliads had a devotion to Molech Baal in the city of Abagarlis. That's a fun name to try and say.
Yeah.
There's a part of the history where they unleashed hordes of undead against their enemies. And this was very specifically due to this connection to Molech Baal, which makes sense. I mean, which Daedric princes would be for necromancy? Well, it seems like Molech Baal would.
Yeah, it seems pretty high on the list of things he would be totally down with.
Yep, yep. So we have a diverse history in Cyrodiil, depending on the culture. But the climate seemed like rainforesty at one point, and then another point it just wasn't anymore. And it's one of those, like, oddities about the series, because the lore seems to not always match up in that regard. But
yeah, there's a lot of thoughts on why it's one way in some documents, another way in game. It's very, very, like, you get the gray area of storytelling over the ages, which is something that I constantly bring up that I love about this game or this whole series. But again, it makes it hard when things are like, well, whose story was real if you weren't there? I mean, the only time we've seen it, it doesn't seem like it's a rainforest.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's a rainforest, which means that the bodies would last a little bit longer. They wouldn't decay as fast. But speaking of places with a little bit more forest and even desert, let's head back down to the south again and go to Elsewhere. And in Elsewhere, you have a little bit of forest, you got a lot of desert, and you also have a bunch of Khajiit. And culturally, the Khajiit are one of the cultures who just don't really care that much about necromancy.
Yeah, they really, it's not like they're for it, but they just, like you said, they don't care.
Yeah.
And when you have a type of culture that tends to be a bit more heavy in smuggling and stuff like that in a lot of ways, suddenly you have a very new market that you can work with.
That's right. That's right. So Khajiit tend to be more known as thieves, and there's a reason for that, and it's because that's kind of part of their culture. It doesn't mean that every Khajiit is a thief, but they certainly tend to be a little bit looser about their rules around that. And there are places like Senchal where you can actually buy corpses, which, I mean, who's buying corpses unless it's doctors doing research? It's going to be necromancers. So that's a thing that has existed historically. But then you also have this idea of, like, graves and grave sites, and traditional Khajiit burial deals with stone cairns, which means that they're actually pretty easy to get into. You combine that with thievery, it's very easy to get to these dead bodies.
I feel like that's a terrible place to get buried.
Yeah, right, right. And on top of it, if it's in one of the desert regions, then the bodies don't decay as quickly.
Right. You've got this arid climate, and it's like, okay, cool. And the likelihood that my grave will be pillaged is high to very high.
Right, right. So if you are a necromancer, you might want to head down to Elsewhere and you can find some bodies, which makes me wonder why we haven't seen a whole lot of Khajiit like zombies in the game. Usually they're other things.
Right. It's not like super common, but again, maybe it's just like, oh, we'll just dig up all the other foreigners who were buried here.
Yeah. Scream and Chat is asking, who are some of the Khajiit necromancers? I don't know of any that we know by name historically. Do you know anybody?
I'm trying to think. Yeah, I was going to say, interestingly enough, there's a lot of people down there, but I'm not thinking of any Khajiit necromancers.
In ESO,
they seem much more into selling off the bodies rather than doing it themselves.
Right. Yeah. In ESO, it's like Imperials. There's an Orc one. There's.
Yeah, Zumeg Fum. That was immediately elves. Who I thought of because he was such a big part of the Elsewhere story. And I'm like, but Zumeg was an Orc. He wasn't a Khajiit.
Yeah. Yeah. Zenith Var is a necromancer, the new follower. Thanks, Booker.
Yes. I was going to say, Zareth Var is a necromancer Far. And also one of that weird ilk that's not an evil necromancer necessarily.
Like, right. We talked about that a little bit last week.
Yes. Yeah. Which we'll get, again, that'll be a large portion of the Dromothar thing because it explains a lot of how it's benevolent necromancy, I guess, for lack of a better word, but it's designed to not be cruel. It's actually supposed to be a form of peace. But again, we can get into that like next time. But yeah, he's the only one I can honestly think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so let's move on from Elsewhere. Let's head back north to another desert location. We're going up to Hammerfell. Large swaths of Hammerfell are desert. So you might think, you know, bodies don't disintegrate as quickly, so maybe they're cooler with it. But turns out that the Red Guards absolutely not on board for necromancy.
Yeah, they're about as extreme with don't touch the dead or even dishonor their memory as it gets.
Yeah, they're descended from Yakuda. Yakudan history becomes Red Guard history. Absolutely against necromancy. Don't even talk about it. Don't even bring it up. It is not.
So extreme that if you are being attacked by a zombie who is a Red Guard, you should not be defending yourself. Because it would be dishonoring the memory of the undead person, even if they're reanimated.
Yeah, yeah. So
which is a real catch 22.
Right. And it has to do with their reverence for their ancestors. Their culture is very highly reverent of their ancestors. So even if somebody got reanimated, to desecrate their body by fighting back would be to harm the body of their ancestor. So it would be better to stop the magic from animating the body than to actually, like, you know, chop apart the zombie that's attacking you. So,
which is great in theory.
Yeah. So this also connects that they don't like necromancy. They have a general distrust of magic, and that's part of the connection to necromancy as to why they have that. If you think about the location, it is a desert. So if you are a necromancer, it seems like a good location to go to find bodies. But, you know, I mean, it seems also more dangerous because somebody finds out you're a
necromancer. Very similar climate-wise to Elsewhere in many regards, but at the same time, the culture is very different.
Right. So here's some other fun stuff. The Ash-Aba are a Red Guard tribe dedicated to purging the undead, I don't know why I put a G there, and purifying mausoleums. So they actually have organizations that are like actively seek out to remove this. Despite their crucial role, they are treated as outcasts and forced to live as nomads in the Hammerfall Wastes. This is cool stuff because it's these little details I hope we get in Elder Scrolls 6 if it is located in a place like Hammerfell. Wouldn't it be cool to come across these like necromancer hunters that are out in the wilds just like surviving on their own?
Yes, and it's interesting just that the fact that, like, you know, we had mentioned before, because attacking the dead, even if they're, you know, zombified or whatever, reanimated, is frowned upon, those who are protecting people from them are outcast by their own society. Yeah. So it's like, it's weird that you're that extra like level of protection, and as a result you're looked down on because of it. It's a weird scenario.
Yeah, I feel like oftentimes you have these groups that go to such a far extreme that they're considered kind of untame or dangerous.
Sure.
Because they're so willing to hold somebody accountable and to do violence against them. So it makes people feel nervous, right? Like I've been watching the new Daredevil series, like a vigilante who's only beating up bad guys is probably helpful in the long run, but they're also kind of skirting the law in a bad way. And so you wouldn't want to associate with them.
And in this situation, it always struck me, because this is actually, if you're interested in this and you do play ESO, if you do the Alakir Desert storyline, there's a lot around this. What I find interesting is the way the Red Guards view them almost is like, yeah, this is necessary. And it's sort of like a wink, wink, nod, nod. It's like, yeah, we know you make everything safer for us, but also we want to stand on our moral high ground. So we're going to pretend that no. We would never do such a thing. But it's like, yeah, but only because somebody else is doing it for you can you keep this moral high ground. It feels very political in the Alakir region and just Red Guard culture in general.
Yeah, that makes sense. One other little detail, we've got the Ansai wards, or wards, W-A-R-D-S, wards. Spelling is weird. So in the first era, three Ansai warriors, also known as sword saints, sacrificed their souls to create the Ansai wards. These relics are very powerful, and they prevent even the strongest necromancers from raising the dead. So their culture goes all the way back to this group that, again, was so anti-necromancy that they were able to do this. And this is connected to their god Tuwaka. I love the names of their gods. Tuwaka, the Yukudan god of souls in the afterlife. And this is all associated with that. So when you think Red Guards, Yukudans, Hammerfell, absolutely anti-necromancy. So let's head north from there up to High Rock. And of course, now we're back into another culture, another Mannish culture, but very different perspective on magic, because they are kind of a blend of, you know, elven descent and Mannish descent. But
right. It's kind of, again, this is sort of like a hybrid race.
Yeah, where, the Brentons. You know,
yeah, the Brentons. They're magically attuned, but at the same time exhibit a lot more human features. They also have become more human as the series has gone on. They definitely were a little more of a mix originally, and now they're just kind of not as much as they used to be, but it's just a design choice sort of.
Right, and if you go up to some of those areas, especially in Elder Scrolls Online, you'll find that they are kind of spooky. There's a lot of like spooky, dark kind of gothic horror quality to some of the locations, which is always fun. I love that stuff. And it makes sense because, you know, vampires and all that, but also necromancy. And turns out that there are necromancers up in High Rock. The Bretons do operate, well, some of them operate, you know, with necromancy, but they're in secret. They're doing things secretively because it's not commonly accepted. But it can also be dangerous to go up there because necromancers might also take travelers, you know, unwillingly and turn them into their undead servants.
Thralls or whatever.
Right. Then we've got these groups. We've got like the Gravesingers, who are the most powerful of the Witchmen of High Rock, and they're known for an extraordinary ability to control the dead. There's Angoth, a powerful Gravesinger who defiled Cath Bedraud, the great cemetery of Breton nobility, and attempted to take over Glenumbra during the Alliance War. And this is the second era of 582. And he was eventually defeated by the Lion Guard of Daggerfell, the Daggerfell Covenant, which is another one of the specific groups that's very against necromancy. And around the same time, necromancers were trafficking in bodies on Betnik, and they were also eradicated. So these are some of the events from like Elder Scrolls Online that kind of tie into this.
Yep, you play this in the Glenumbra Zone.
Yep. So there's a few different historical threats. In the third era, the people of Dwinin suffered under a lich in his undead hordes until Baron Othrock defeated him. And that's in the year 253 of the third era. In 267, Othrock led a coalition of High Rock nationals to defend the Camran usurper, whose undead armies had terrorized Western Tamriel for over a decade. And I feel like this is indicative of necromancy becoming more and more used, even though it was highly outlawed throughout history. But as you move through the eras, there's more and more like, well, this dude raised a bunch of undead and decided to attack this place. Or like you run around in Skyrim in the fourth era and it's like, how many caves have undead creatures and necromancers just kind of living in them?
We're just hanging out, right?
Just exactly. Hanging out. Yeah. So one of the ways that the Bretons are able to cut down on necromancy is through the way that they handle their dead. So for example, cremation is normal in the culture, which makes, you know, collecting somebody's bones or body a little bit more difficult. There are, in the southern areas, tombs, and tomb burials are more common, kind of like in the imperial style, and that makes their bodies actually more possible of getting, because they're entombed and kind of, you know, removed from the elements in order to make the bodies able to be got. So there's a few different ways that they can get bodies also, because with all the different warring groups, there are conflicts and battlefields, and the dead in the battlefields are also great places for necromancers to find bodies as well, because oftentimes it takes people a while to actually deal with the bodies in the fields. So that happens as well. But then there's also the black market. There are necromancy trades.
There's always the black market.
Yeah, kind of like in Elsewhere, where like the sewers of Wayrest, you can go find bodies if you're really looking for them. So there you go.
Yep, you just gotta know who to ask.
Yes. Now, there are other groups in that area other than, say, like the aristocracy and those people and the commoners. There's also druids, and according to some druids, they see necromancy as actually a legitimate spiritual practice, and this has to do with Ifrei and Ifrei's blessing of life and all of that kind of stuff. So there is some diversity in perspectives of necromancy in that part of the world.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
So there you go. That's that place.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to add anything else to that.
Yeah, no, I'm good.
Let's head to another place where they absolutely do not like necromancy at all. Morrowind, another culture that venerates their dead and talks with their ancestors and all of that. So
yeah, this is kind of a theme. It seems like in a lot of situations, the more you venerate your ancestors and the dead, the less you're going to want anything to do with necromancy.
Yes. So they made necromancy illegal fairly early on, and it stayed illegal until the third era, 427. And this coincides with some of the changes in in Morrowind's culture following the tribunal and all of that stuff. So the region tends to change over time based on who's in charge and also the diversity of people who live there, because over time you have the import of these other cultures, mostly as slaves, but it becomes more diverse. So you have diverse perspectives and then laws change. So there's some weirdness going on there, but then you also have groups of dark elves like the Telvanni who are seeking power and control over magic. And so this becomes something that they engage with. And some of this started with, like, you know, using it on birds or animals and these kinds of things, and eventually making its way to humans and all the terribleness that comes with that.
Yeah, but circle back to what we originally said. It's like, yeah, it's weird how your scruples go out the window when it relates to getting more power.
Right. And slavery is a big thing in Morrowind as well. So
especially amongst the Telvanni and the House Dress.
Right. So you would think that, like, some of these groups would be more okay with necromancy because it's just like slavery that continues after death.
Yeah, it's just post-life slavery.
Post-life. Great. Yeah, post-life slavery. So
wonderful. That's very appealing.
Yeah. So you got that. So that's Morrowind. Let's head over to Orsinium. The location of Orsinium changes over time, depending on what area you're in and all of that.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot to say about the orc perspective of necromancy. Necromancers in general, though, consider orc corpses highly valuable because they tend to be more durable and they've got stronger bones than some of the other races, which would be very disturbing to me if I was an orc, because I would be like, I would constantly have this fear of, like, I don't know, I hope no necromancer doesn't come after me after I'm dead.
Yeah, I just like how you know, the bones are real strong, make real good skeleton monsters.
Yeah. And this is actually true to the point where toward the end of the third era, there were a group of necromancers who attempted to establish a trade route with the orcs in order to get corpses from Orsinium. And we don't know how that ended. We don't know the result of this.
I mean, if it's anything like Khajiit, it's probably not great for whoever was dead nearby.
Yeah, right? Like, can you imagine being somebody in power who's like, well, we can make a little bit extra money if we just let them raid the graves.
Man, we could probably get rid of our yurt taxes if we just sell a couple.
So, yeah, so that's Orsinium.
Sell a couple extra relatives who aren't being used.
Oh, man. I hope, and this is another one of those things I hope we get in Elder Scrolls 6, is like a Khajiit bodies used in necromancy, orc bodies used in necromancy. Like, I would imagine you'd have
durabilities too.
Right. Yeah. You'd have different like races showing up, but certain ones maybe more often than others, or certain ones at different durability levels, so they're harder to fight.
That would be really funny. It's like, oh man, this skeleton's really frustrating. Like higher level skeletons are just like, right. Yep. It becomes an orc skeleton like after a certain threshold because it's more durable.
Yeah. So yeah. Or like even like thralls or like zombies, like, oh, this one's real big. Oh, because it's an orc. It's right. Got a lot of meat on its bones. So, all right. So let's go from Orsinium up to the far north. We're going to back to Skyrim. I was just in Skyrim today because I was playing Skyrim. But Skyrim, favorable conditions for corpses because it's so cold that the bodies just freeze when they die.
Yeah, it's like putting them in the fridge.
Yeah, just get them in the freezer.
Just put them right in the freezer, yeah.
Freeze exactly. Up that body. Maybe that's why when we play Skyrim, we come across so many places with corpses and skeletons and things, is because they last for a long time.
Yeah, it's just perfect environment.
Yeah, so in general, the Nords, not fans of necromancy, overall, but that doesn't mean that they don't have their necromancers. It also doesn't mean that, like, if you think about the history of Skyrim, I mean, what do you come across in many of the underground locations?
I was going to say, and 85% of what you fight are Draugr.
Yeah, Draugr. Like, you come across, they're basically zombies.
Yes, they're.
Yeah, so you've got, like, the dragon cults and the turning of these, you know, servants into these undying servants for eternity, it seems.
That's kind of the thing. That's a weird gray area, I find. A weird gray beard area. I'm sorry.
gray beard area?
I apologize for that really lame joke. But yeah, it's just like the situation of like, well, I mean, it's sort of part of the culture that, yeah, okay, they're not big into necromancy, but also essentially it's the undead who are taking care of these crypts and the dragon priests. So right. It's
not just historically the dragon priests. So for example, there's Potima Septim, the wolf queen, who used necromantic armies during the War of the Red Diamond in the third era, 120 through 137, and turned solitude basically into a land of death. That sounds great.
That's great.
That's great. Yeah,
that's great.
That's good
great.
Times.
Yeah, that's good times.
That sounds good times. Yeah, eventually, she was defeated in 137.
The Wolf Queen really went off the rails.
Right. But then it doesn't, it's not done yet. The Fourth Era, 201, this is like 1,000 years later, a group of necromancers attempted to summon and bind her spirit, but the ritual was thwarted by you, the Dragonborn. This is part of the reason why you hear about the War of the Red Diamond. I think there's a book you can get and read about it in the game. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff, right? This ties into one of the things that happens in the game, which is a continuation of a necromancer story. Good times.
Good. Nothing about this sounds like good times.
Yeah.
And it's just awful reanimated times.
Right. And not only that, not only do we have the Draugr, we have the Wolf Queen, but we also have Reach Folk, and the Reach Folk also pretty down with necromantic practices.
Indeed. And that's a situation where you really kind of do, again, run into, it doesn't overtly seem like you're dealing with undead in certain scenarios. But one thing that is very interesting is Briar Hearts themselves are dead and reanimated. So, you know, that's sort of the same scenario. It's just how they go about it is different.
Yeah. And it's
sort of grow you like a mini tree.
Right. Yeah. They use it kind of like the druids. They use kind of this like earth plant kind of magic in order to reanimate things. So you've got another weird version of necromancy there. So, although Skyrim as a whole, not pro-necromancy, seems like a lot of its denizens at different times in history absolutely were.
I was going to say, not pro-necromancy, but wink, wink, are totally pro-necromancy.
Yes, yes. So here, let's head down to the south. Let's go talk about some more elves. Let's go to Somerset. Somerset Isles, of course, the seemingly home of Manny Marco, although he may have been an Aldmer who may have actually come to Tamriel from over the sea. Who even knows? So you've got that stuff going on. But in general, in the Altmer culture, necromancy is absolutely forbidden. It is, they're not down with it. It's not a cool thing. There are, though, of course, some loopholes. Some of the Altmer elites were willing to study these things and were given a limited ability to do so at different points in history. You have connections to things like soul trapping, soul gems, that part of the culture. So you got a little bit of that stuff going on historically, but unlike Skyrim, there's not like these roving bands of necromancers across the landscape kind of.
Yeah. They're not just stuff. Like trading them bodies at local thrift stores and stuff.
Right. If anything, it was like the rare situation of somebody like Manny Marco, a very powerful mage, overstepping the bounds of what they were supposed to do. So you got that sort of thing going on with the Altmer. Also, there's Thras and the Slowed, who are kind of connected to this part of the world as well. And like we mentioned with, Black Marsh, they show back up every so often. They use necromancy. They're in conflict with the Altmer. So you got a little bit of that stuff going on down there too.
Yeah, and I was going to say, Thras in general, that's a free-for-all. I mean, if we go off the actual continent of Tamriel, that's just like, whatever, man. Like, they're good to go. It doesn't matter.
Right, right. All right, so the last place we need to go is Valinwood, and we've got the Bosmer. And in general, in this culture, similar to the Altmer and some of these other cultures, generally frowned upon, not a good idea. This is interesting. Bosmer do not practice Arkay's protective rites, but their tradition of ritual cannibalism reduces corpse availability, making Valinwood a difficult place for necromancers. So unlike the environment decaying the bodies and making them more difficult to use, the fact that traditionally they weren't against eating bodies, there's not much left after they eat the bodies.
I would argue that's the funniest reason in the series why there aren't a lot of bodies. It's like, oh man, I gotta clean up the streets after our war. Better eat all these corpses.
Well, we got a lot of food.
Exactly. I mean, we can't be eating these berries. We might as well eat our bodies. So,
So here's
and some as a side effect. It's like, I love how that's just one vice that solves a different vice in the environment. Right.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh man, this is super. I mean, cannibalism is not considered an okay thing throughout the series overall, but then like in Bosmer culture, okay, that's part of the Green Pact. But then as a side effect, it's like, well, most people also are not good with necromancy overall, but this other taboo subject ends up negating another. It's just weird that it's just like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. You get so many vices at once in one region that it kind of balances out.
It kind of eats itself.
Yeah, exactly.
So we have
terrible, terrible jokes.
So that's just how we do. That's how we roll. So we do have one story about necromancy in Valinwood that we know about. So the ancient alien city of Hectahaim was built in the heart of Valinwood. This is a place of immense power. And there was a forgotten necromancer who corrupted the heart, raised an undead horde so powerful that the city had to be sealed off forever. In the year 249 of the Third Era, the Cameron Usurper used Daedric and necromantic forces to conquer Valinwood in just 2 years. So we've got kind of some events of necromancy leading to historical situations, but in general, not very common in this region. So
yeah, I mean, there's not really much more to say on that. It's just, it's another one where it's just like, you know, more being frowned on in the overall grand scheme of things, and they just have their own situation as to why it's kind of less frequent.
Right, yeah. So there you go. This is all the different areas across Tamriel where necromancy comes up and where we know about what the culture thinks or the way that they would or wouldn't do necromancy.
Does what they think match with what they act?
Right. As with so many of these topics that we study them, Lotus, and we get into the nitty gritty, it turns out that there's a lot more here than I initially thought. when, you know, a few weeks ago I was like, hey, we should move on and do some stuff about necromancy. Maybe we do an episode. Turns out,
yeah,
there's a lot to know.
Yeah, exactly. The more you dig into it, it's like, well, there's a lot to this other than just the like surface level of I make dead thing not so dead.
Right. Yeah. And there's kind of the meta perspective. I mean, if you're going to design a game, you need some sort of fodder for enemies, right?
Sure.
So like you need aggressive animals, you need Daedric monsters, you need, oh, maybe we'll have some skeletons and some zombies. You need something that the general populace is generally afraid of, whether that's somebody's army or
right, a horde but what of is you as a hero can cleave through.
Right, right. And I think that's part of the fun. Like in the playthrough that I was doing this morning, I'm doing an evil baby playthrough. This is the most recent one. Come check it out. It's a lot of fun. I used console commands in Skyrim to shrink myself to like a third of the size of, I come up to like people's knees, a little bit above their knees, right? And I noticed in one of the it was like a cave I went into, there were some skeletons and I'm attacking the skeleton and swinging at it. And it's gigantic because I'm tiny and I zoom out to third person and I'm fighting the skeleton. And I get the final hit in and I cleave it across like the ankles basically, and the physics kick in and the legs fly off because you know how the bones will scatter. It's so good. The legs fly off and then they go sideways, hit the wall, and the rest of the skeleton falls down just like what would happen if you just kind of knock the legs out from underneath the skeleton. I was like, oh, this is so cool. This is so cool.
To this day, I still love the wacky skeleton physics.
I love it. Yeah, I love it. It's so good. And on top of it, I was using like combat mods, which made like the impact even more interesting and effective for physics. It was so cool to just see that happen. I had no idea if I was baby scale that I would knock the legs out from skeletons, but
man. He's too weak and frail.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, he got beat by a baby. So there you go. That's necromancy. We're going to be following this up next week with Dramothra stuff, and
yep,
that'll be fun.
I think that'll close up the chapter on this.
Yeah, kind of this whole undead thing. We've talked about vampires and werewolves before, so ghosts and things like that have come up, but I don't think we've ever covered necromancy the way we did right here. So
yeah, it's always been kind of referred to and not delved into specifically. Same thing with Dramothra. It's like a lot of times so much of this stuff ties into each other, we make reference to it, but sometimes it's like, oh wow, there's a lot here once you really start digging in.
Yeah, yeah. So tell you what, we're gonna take a quick break. We got to go thank our patrons. When we get back, we've got our extra like random page thing from the UESP, and you know what, I forgot to pull up as we set this up, see if we have any new voicemails, so I'll get that set up and we'll be right back.
This is Hamish Morak, Dragonborn, and you are educating yourself to the Elder Scrolls Lorecast.
All right, we're back. Let's thank our newest patrons. Patreon.com/Elder Scrolls Lorecast if you want to help support the show. You get some really cool stuff. There's a bunch of the early episodes that you can only get if you are on the Patreon. There's also t-shirts and stickers, ad-free episodes, all sorts of things. And we have to welcome Tyler N, Haven G, and Christina C. Welcome to the Patreon. Thank you for signing up and supporting us. We really appreciate that. And also, thanks to all 144 of our paying supporters. Thank you to all of you. And we have to shout our Daedric Princes out. We've got Blinding Vision, Hersin, Kirasi, and Peter R. Thanks so much for your support as well.
Appreciate all of you.
Yeah. If you want to help us in other ways, you can leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We don't have any new ones, at least in the U.S. that I can see right now. But please do that, even if you're not in the U.S. It really does help. You can also rate the show on Spotify. You can share it with your friends, all of that stuff. But
yeah, on Spotify, we're getting very close to 1,000 reviews.
Like, oh, wow. I didn't notice.
Yeah. I just had somebody at my work actually was checking out the show.
Yeah.
And they were looking at it and they're like, oh, they're like, wow, you have a lot of like stars. I was like, well, yeah, I mean, like not everybody necessarily loves us 5-star worthy, but at the same time, there's a lot of you because we do have a relatively high rating. So it's like, well, I'm glad at least most people like it. And then you take the time to actually give us a little star rating. It's appreciated.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. Oh, this screen is bright. All right. I'm looking over here. We got some audio messages. We're going to save the bonus page right for the end. But we've got, let's see. This one has come in. We've got a new one that comes in that just came in. Let me make sure the volume's up for everybody to hear it. Here we go. This is from Forced Floppa.
Hey guys, my name is Floppa, and I'm a long-time listener of this show, for 4 to 5 years already. Or at least, I think you've been going on for that long. I even attended a Patreon episode once, and I would love to do so more often. But as a European, I feel like the time is too inconvenient, unfortunately. Still, I'm very happy to listen, and I've been doing so loyally as part of my weekly ritual. I have a question for both of you, maybe more specifically directed to Tom, because I know you're versed in theology. I wonder what the real-life counterparts are of some of the Daedric princes, for instance. You talked about them in a long series of episodes, but I always like it when you see these parallels, when you make these bridges to real-world literature, real-world art, or even religion as we humans know it. Because I know the developers derive a lot of inspiration from those sources. I wonder what your insights and perceptions are on this. And maybe in the future you can make more connections between those? I don't know. I'm very interested. And I think you guys are doing a great job. So keep at it.
All right. Thanks, Forced Floppa.
Hey, Floppa. I was going to say, yeah. Long time no chat.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so sorry that we can't. It's time zones are a pain in the butt. Because
tell me about it. Ark and I go through a bi-weekly nightmare to figure out how to record our show.
Yeah, yeah. So the reason why, just so everybody understands, the reason why we record at 9 p.m. Eastern is because most of our listeners, the bulk of our listeners, something about like 60% of our listeners are in the U.S. So the bulk of our patrons are in the U.S. And 9 p.m. is after work Eastern time, which means it's 6 p.m. Pacific. So across the entire country generally is after work hours for most people, right? And then that means that it is really late in Europe, and it's even later as you get further across the continent and into places like Asia or the Middle East or wherever. And it's not as convenient for everybody over there, but there's just isn't a perfect time for everybody. So, but thank you for the support, Force Floppa, and this question. So I'm just gonna have to respond off the top of my head about this connection between Daedric princes and religion. In fact, that seems like a fun episode for Lotus for us to cover sometime in the future.
Yeah, that actually sounds like a great topic.
Yeah, if I mean, given a little bit of time to like really prepare, and we could build an entire topic out of it. If we actually do the preparation for it. But off the top of my head, Daedric princes seem to derive more inspiration from traditions with pantheons of gods, multi-god pantheons, and less individual gods. Like, there's not as much. I mean, you do have demonic entities like Molech Baal, which feels like it's very Christian kind of influenced in its perception, and it depends on the version of Christian in different parts of history and those kinds of things, but a more like medieval to modern day, you know, devil with horns kind of Christianity thing going on there. But for the other Daedric princes, you have, they all seem to take over certain realms. So you have, say, a trickster deity, somebody like Clavicus Vile's kind of a trickster, or Shagorth's kind of a trickster. So that feels kind of like Loki from the Norse pantheon. You have some of these deities that have more to do with nature in certain ways, or disease, or light and life, and those kinds of things. And so when you have diverse gods, like say in the Greek pantheon or the Roman pantheon or the Egyptian pantheon, you have certain deities that kind of fill a little bit more of those roles. And on top of it, the Daedra are all about themselves more than their followers, and there's a lot of commonality in there as well for these like pantheon of gods, where the gods were kind of these extrapolations of humanity made big, but still very selfish in a lot of ways, and were not necessarily totally benevolent beings. So there are some connections there as well. But yeah, definitely a lot of influence, yet kind of turned on its side. And then you even have more oddities with things like Talos and a mortal who gains divinity being connected to. In fact, there's a bunch of different, I mean, there's not just Jesus, there's other stories of people who were either born divine or gained divinity in different religious beliefs and mythologies and things like that. So you have some of that stuff going on too. But yeah, we'll have to put that on their back pockets as a list to kind of go through and divide them up and kind of categorize them and see what maybe some of their influences were. Great question, Forrest. Really appreciate that. Lotus, do you have anything else you want to say about this column?
No, actually, I just like that topic idea. And again, you kind of covered the couple that I would just have any opinion on off the top of your head, similar to me. I haven't studied this the way you have, really. So it's like, I would be interested in kind of diving into that for sure. And just seeing like, oh, this actually has like a whole bunch of parallels that I didn't even know were there.
Yeah. There's a little bit from monotheism, a little bit from polytheism. It's all kind of mixed together, mostly from polytheism. That's just my gut right now.
I feel a lot of Michael Kirkbride's writing, mm-hmm. not specifically to Daedric Prince's only, but like to his lore, a lot of his writing seems to have really strong parallels to religion in a lot of ways.
Yes.
So I'm sure outside just Daedric Prince's, a lot of what he was involved with probably has some pretty deep ties to this stuff.
Yeah. And he even pulls in some of these old philosophies like Gnosticism and some of these other things. Like, and he mixes those in as well. And it basically cooks all the little ingredients together and then you get something completely different. So that's a lot of fun. But yeah, thanks for the question. And if you would like to leave us a voicemail for us to talk about or, you know, play at the end of one of these shows, voiceline.app/Elder Scrolls. Really easy. voiceline.app/Elder Scrolls. There's a link in the description of the show. So if you don't know where it is, look at the details underneath the rest of the, you know, the player for the show, and you'll find a link in there. So awesome. All right. You ready for our random page?
Sure.
Random page time. I hit the random button and we got an item. This is from Elder Scrolls Ooh. Online. It's under the subcategory Furnishings Suite Mirrors. This is
as in a suite. I was like, sweet, like what?
Sweet
as sweet, in like dude. A place you would stay. A suite, not right. It's a suite mirror.
Something you would put in a home or something, right?
Correct.
In a bedroom or something like that. So this is the Apocrypha Mirror Spiked.
Ooh.
This is an epic quality, traditional furnishings. This is a standard house item. That's the description. This furnishing can be created at an enchanting station with a Praxis Apocrypha Mirror Spiked furnishing plan. It takes the following materials. All right. Do you want this? I love going over the materials because sometimes they don't make any sense.
I absolutely. It's part of my favorite thing is the fact that some of the materials don't make any sense. Like, what was it that we made last time that it didn't involve the actual thing? Oh, mug crab.
It was a crab. Yeah, but it didn't have any crab in it.
Correct.
Which was great. All right. This synthetic. One. Yeah, so what would you assume is a key component of a mirror?
Well, I would hope glass is going to be included.
Yes. And that one is included.
Oh, amazing. All right.
We actually get glass in this one, but it's a very special kind of glass. Two of the Glass Eye of Mora.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Mm, that sounds interesting. Mora's glass eyes. We also 13 mundane runes, 10 regulus, 6 alchemical resin, and 3 rakuta. Those are the components. Okay.
All right.
And then you get an Apocrypha Mira spiked. And this one looks like some of the designs from Apocrypha, which makes sense with Hermaeus Mora. So there you go. That's our random USP page of the day.
That was indeed random.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody, for coming out and hanging out during the live show. We really do appreciate it. I've got the chat up in the corner now. So if you ever want to see what chat is seeing and how we're responding to people, you can check out the video. Also, the video versions are going up on Patreon. So it pulls the audio out of it. So you'll have the audio or the video version to watch or listen to if you're one of our patrons. So that's an upgrade as well. We're trying to raise things up a little bit and continue the improvements. And remember, there is still time to get into the entry to win a key for ESO, including the newest chapter. So go get on that. Send me some more crazy ideas of things to do in Skyrim, and I might be streaming those on like Thursday and Friday mornings, and also any other days that I have some opportunity to do that. But thanks everybody for tuning in. Lotus, any last thoughts? Any last words?
No, not really. I was going to say it's another fun episode. And if you're interested in more stuff Elder Scrolls, you can always check out our my other show, Tales of Tamriel, presented by the unofficial Elder Scrolls pages, which obviously we use a lot of their information for not just our super random page to end the show, but where we get all of our wiki information from. Well, not all of it, but a lot of it. That's definitely more of a conversational show as opposed to us teaching something here. So it's also tends to be a little longer format sometimes, but we've it's not as long as it was before. Generally, we try to keep it under 2 hours.
Three and a half hour shows.
Yeah, yeah. Correct. But yeah, so you can always check that out if that's something you're interested in. But other than that, that's pretty much it for me.
There you go. And yeah, I talked about my stuff that's going on. Absolutely would love you coming by the Twitch streams. Actually, it's Twitch and it's also the Robots Radio YouTube channel. Both of them go live at the same time. And I'm trying to, I'm so bad at sticking to schedules with this, but I've cleared a lot of things out for my schedule. I'm trying to make this a thing. Mornings on Thursdays and Fridays are going to be the official time, starting around 9 a.m. So come hang out. I'm doing all sorts of weird stuff in Skyrim. And chat has been very helpful because, Lotus, when was the last time you did like a full Skyrim playthrough?
Oh, Lord.
Not just jumping in and dabbling in or putting in a mod and trying something out.
I want to say
one of the quest lines, a full
playthrough.
It was
when the PS3 was still new, because I think the last time I platinumed the game was on PS3.
Yeah.
So that would have been, so whenever the hell, before PS4 came out, so what was that, 2013?
Yeah, it's about the same for me too, because in the intervening years, I've installed mods, I've done little bits of playthroughs here and there, I've loaded up an old file and just kind of dabbled around in it. And then a lot of ESO and other stuff, but it, like I'm not remembering where things are. It's been so long. It's been great to be like, wait, where is that? How does that work? Where do I go?
It feels new again.
Yeah, it kind of feels new again. Plus, all the mods have kind of updated the locations. The cities are more built out. There's a whole bunch of, everything's a little bit different in a way where I'm like, wait, was this over here? I don't really remember. And chat's been super helpful with like helping me navigate stuff or remember how to do things. So absolutely, it's been a blast. And this is genuinely something I'm doing for my own mental health as well, because it gives me, I work out of the home all day long. I don't hang out with other people very much. So being able to like hang out with chat and talk and do this stuff has really been helpful. So thanks everybody for being here and supporting the show. We love you guys. You guys are the best. It's an awesome community. All right. So that's going to do it for this show. Until next time, think twice about necromancy before you decide to raise an army and take on undead things. And if you do, you now know where to go find corpses. So you're welcome for that.
Or at least places you will get less likely to be arrested.
There you go. All right. We'll see you next time. Bye, everybody.
See you later.
Thanks for tuning in to the Elder Scrolls Lorecast. Check out robotsradio.net for more podcasts just like this. And join us on the Robots Radio Discord. Be part of a community of over 5,000 people who are excited about video games and so much more. Robots Radio. Games. Lore. Stories, community. Just press play.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.